Follow the Moskwa down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change.
Hello, this is Christopher Bolin, speaking to you today on the 13th of October. I have with me today Helia Kaskel, my wife, and we are producing this audio file for the benefit of my listeners and readers on my website, bolin.com. I want to thank my supporters who have helped make this possible through their generous donations. The reason why I'm making this audio file, and I'll make audio files like this in the future, is to discuss my articles and my research and to hopefully put to an end the defamation and rumors that I am not writing my articles or that something's happened to me and I'm not around.
Or that we are not making our own website.
Right. Helia is actually the webmaster, the web mistress of my website, of our website. That's www.bolin.com. And Bolin is spelled B as in boy, OLLYN.com.
And I'm currently building up the archives of Christopher's articles, which is a vast subject, and whenever we have any problems there, then you can blame me.
Well, the thing is, today is the 13th of October, and I've been very busy. This is a Saturday. I've been very busy in the last week trying to finish up an article about September 11th, which is all new material. It's I've come across a major discovery, if you will, of the connections in what happened on September 11th. And it's the result of research that I've been doing in the past. Actually, it's a continuation of the research that I was doing in August of 2006, when I was interrupted by three undercover police who came to my house and tasered me and broke my elbow. Following that, I was prosecuted, what we call malicious prosecution, which took up the better part of a year. And I was forced to leave Chicago area. And now, only since July or August, really, I've been able to dedicate my attention to the unsolved crime of 9/11. And I wrote quite a few articles. I have some of them in front of me that that are peripheral or tangential to what I've discovered recently. The most recent article that I wrote just before I came across this find was called D'Amato and Giuliani, Closely Tied to Israeli Military Intelligence. And this article, I found that Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City, and Alphonse D'Amato, the former senator from New York State, who's also from Long Island, were members of the National Advisory Board of an organization called the America-Israel Friendship League. Now, this Friendship League is more than a grassroots organization bringing Israelis and American people closer together on the grassroots level. This organization has an American board of directors and an Israeli board of directors. The head of the organization on the United States is a man called Kenneth J. Bjelken. And Mr. Bjelken is a very high-level Zionist in the New York establishment in the United States. And he is the president and chairman of the United States Board of the American-Israel Friendship League. Mr. Bjelken is also the partner in a law firm called Skadden Arps. And Skadden Arps is one of the key law firms involved in the 9/11 litigation. A woman named Sheila Birnbaum is also a partner at Skadden Arps. And Ms. Birnbaum is the special mediator for the 9/11 relatives who have not solved, who have not had their lawsuits resolved. There were originally 96 families who chose not to take the compensation from the United States government, but wanted to litigate in the hope of finding accountability and justice for the loss of their loved ones. Now, Ms. Birnbaum is working in the court of Alvin K. Hellerstein in the Southern District of New York City. And Ms. Birnbaum is now left with fewer than 20 cases, I believe, of the original 96. All of the other 75, 76 cases have already been settled out of court. Now, the next court date will be November 5th. And what's interesting here is that 6 years after 9/11, not a single relative's lawsuit has gone to trial. And there hasn't been any meaningful discovery. And the object of Ms. Birnbaum's work is to settle all the cases before they can go to trial. Now, Helia, the thing is that you know from the Estonia catastrophe that litigation is not a quick or easy way to get justice or discovery.
That's right. In Estonia case, when 13 years ago, 852 people died in a worst ship catastrophe in Europe after the Second World War, our case was started in a court in Paris 11 years ago, and it hasn't gone anywhere during this time. The whole process has been in a legal foot dragging. The very first thing was that one of the defendants was
excused
by the judge, yeah, on the request of a Swedish government. It was a Swedish maritime administration. That was very weird, and it was actually a minister called Mona Sahlin, who is also known as an Estonian minister, who personally wanted to make sure that she had spoken to the judge before the first hearing in the court, that the Swedish maritime administration was let go, mm-hmm, and that relatives would not get their own investigation,
right,
to the causes of the sinking.
Now, here's the point. The point is that the Estonia catastrophe happened in 1994, and for, 13 years, there's been no meaningful discovery, there's been no access to the wreck, and there's been no process in the litigation.
Right. Access to the site of the catastrophe,
the evidence,
or evidence is crucial. But in Estonia case, the Swedish government made a law. They drew a square in the bottom of the sea, whereas the ship sank in international waters, mm-hmm, and they made a no diving
ban.
Mm-hmm. So nobody can ban in the place where Estonia sank.
Right.
And in order to make it more powerful, they got all the countries around the Baltic Sea, mm-hmm, plus Great Britain, mm-hmm, to sign this treaty. So if one country would like to go and dive, mm-hmm, and get some evidence, they have to get the permission from all the rest of the countries. And so they are very effectfully have really restricted the access to the evidence.
Right. Okay. Now, so these are the key things in a cover up of a major catastrophe like the Estonia sinking or like 9/11, when a government wants to conceal or a party wants to conceal the truth, they have to control three fundamental aspects of the discovery process. The first one is the investigation and the access to the evidence. The second one is the interpretation of the event, how the event is explained to the public. And the last one is the subsequent litigation of the lawsuits. So we've seen here in the Estonia catastrophe, we saw the exact same thing. We saw a government-controlled investigation that was very slow and delayed and problematic, followed by, well, complete a violation or prohibition of access to the evidence. Yes. And a...
the manipulation of the evidence.
Right.
Of course, during that time, they also destroy evidence.
Right, but
and manipulate with it.
But by blocking access to the wreck in the shallow water of the Baltic Sea,
yes,
in international waters, they've prohibited people from going down and seeing the ship itself, what happened to it. And this is exactly the same with September 11th. We have a very tightly controlled government investigation run by Michael Chertoff, the former assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division of the Department of Justice at the time, followed by complete confiscation of evidence and then blocking of the evidence. The FBI has collected evidence, for example, the videotapes from the World Trade Center or from the Pentagon and the jet engine parts that landed in New York City, and they have not produced this evidence yet, 6 years later. Then, of course, the controlled media only gives the official version of the catastrophe, doesn't raise any questions, and then, of course, we have the controlled litigation. Now, in the article, returning to that article that I wrote about D'Amato and Giuliani, I didn't mention the most important aspect of this Israeli Friendship League, America-Israel Friendship League, and that is that on the Israeli side, the chairman of the organization is a man named Rothschild. He's a Major General Danny Rothschild, the former head of Israeli military intelligence. Now, this organization is obviously more than a grassroots organization. When you have the former chairman of Israeli Military Intelligence Research Department, I think it's called Aman, on the chairman of an organization which Alphonse D'Amato and Rudy Giuliani belong to. If we go further down in this article, we see the other men who are working with Rothschild on this organization. And they are other generals in the Israeli intelligence. One was a man named Gadi Zohar, who was the head of the anti-terror research operation for intelligence military intelligence, and other people like that. Seeing that this organization is all about, and looking at Alphonse D'Amato's background, you know, we see that Alphonse D'Amato was involved in some very strange business with Unisys back in the late 80s. And Unisys is a company that was had an operation in Great Neck, New York, where they made radar systems for the Aegis system. They produced the radar for that. And Alphonse D'Amato was involved in a influence buying bribery scandal with his brother Armand D'Amato from 1986 to 1988, I believe. It was finally discovered, and it was a big scandal. And Alphonse D'Amato's brother had been paid something like $120,000 to persuade his brother to purchase the Unisys Aegis radar system made in Great Neck, New York, for the United States Navy. And in 1988, the United States Navy did buy the Aegis system from Unisys at a cost of about $100 million. Now, when I saw the name Great Neck pop up in this research, it put up a yellow flag because Great Neck is a very small community on Long Island on the North Shore, which is extremely Jewish and very close to Israel. Sometimes people that live there or know about Great Neck will refer to it as a shtetl because it has such a Jewish character. Now, one of the more interesting people who live in Great Neck is a Israeli aeronautical engineer named Shalom Yaron. Shalom Yaron is not his real name. He was born, I think, Selim Schneider in Poland. But when he went to Israel, he became Shalom Yaron. And what's interesting about Shalom Yaron is that he was the president of Bedeck Aviation, which is the parent company of the Israel Aircraft Industries, which is the largest industry in Israel. They maintain and produce the missiles and the planes and maintain the planes for the Israeli military and for many, many commercial airlines today. Now, Shalom Yaron stands out because he retired from this very senior position in Israel in 1950 and came to America. And ostensibly, he came to America to talk about his youth as a partisan, as a freedom fighter, so to speak, or a fighter against the Nazi occupation of Poland, and how he fought in Belarusia and in Poland against the Germans. But if you read his biography, it's very strange. He's made a career out of this little biography, but he has a much more important function in the United States than talking about his role in the Jewish partisan brotherhood that he fought in Belarusia. When he came to the United States in 1979, he was appointed the president and chairman of a company called Atasco. And Atasco is at the center of my new research, and it involves the Israeli aircraft industry. It involves the Mossad. It is closely tied to one of the key defendants in September 11th, and it is involved right in the middle of what happened on September 11th. This article is almost complete. By the time you hear this audio file, the article will probably be done. And if you want to read this article I'm only making available to subscribers, to people who support my research, because I spent a lot of time on this research. And the only way to support me is to go to my website, www.bolin.com, and via PayPal, for example, you can send a donation to shop@bolinbooks.com. That's shop, S-H-O-P, Bolin Books, bolinbooks.com. And many people have already subscribed or donated and will be getting a copy of this article. And if you would like to get a copy of this article and subsequent research on September 11th, you should go to bolin.com and go to the About Bolin page, and there you can have all the information, and you can send a PayPal donation through that address, shop@bolinbooks.com. So,
they can go directly to PayPal, paypal.com, and use the email address and
send their donation. Yes, and they should include in the message that they provide, if they're writing from another email address, that they send me the email address that they want that to be sent to. Otherwise, I'll simply send it to the address that they're writing from. So we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue with the meat of the research. So thank you very much, and we'll be right back.
Children of tomorrow, dream away.
Good afternoon. This is Christopher Bolin again. I'm back for the second section of the show. I have with me today Helya Koskell. It's October 13th, and we are in the studio where we're putting together this audio file. This is the first audio file that we're doing in this way, and there will be more. If we're going to continue doing this audio file, we need some support. This is the takes time, takes money, and our research there are costs involved. So if you would like to subscribe or if you would like to support my research, you can go to www.bolin.com or send a donation via PayPal to shop@bolinbooks.com. Now, when we left off, I was talking about these Israeli companies, these Israeli aviation companies who are tied to the what I call the 9/11 terror network. And I mentioned a man named Shalom Yaron, who was the former head of Israel Aircraft Industry and the president of Bedek Aviation, which is the parent company, the maintenance company. Now, Israel Aviation Industry has had companies in the United States and in America, on the American continent, since the early 70s. The details of this will be in my research, but in my article about this that's forthcoming. But I have to back up a little bit and revisit some of the anomalies that are prevailing in the September 11th conspiracy. And that is that there is a question of what planes actually were used on September 11th. And we don't have very good information of the Flight 11 that hit North Tower. But we do have some photographs and images and videos of the plane that is said to be Flight 175 striking the South Tower. And there are many anomalies. Those of you who have seen Dave von Kleist's video in plain sight or have read some of the articles about September 11th and the planes are aware that there are many anomalies. Without going into all of the anomalies, the photographs of this plane and the videos of this plane indicate that this plane does not have the profile of a 767-200, I believe it is, but seems to have a longer front fuselage. And rather than being a 767-200, it appears to be a 767-300. That is that the nose section, the section from the beginning of the wing to the nose is longer than it should be on a 767-200. And this has been analyzed by people who have looked at these images from of the United Airlines, what appears to be United Airlines plane striking the South Tower. Now, one of the things is that the plane also has on the bottom by the tail, it has a very visible round hole, which is exactly where you would find the round hole on a 767 tanker aircraft. And, there's been some research about the size of the fireball that emanated, that came from this crash, and some German engineers have concluded that a 767-200 fully loaded would not have contained the amount of fuel necessary to account for the huge fireball and smoke cloud observed. Now, I don't know. I haven't done that research, but I can say that there are a number of anomalies about this aircraft that indicate that it may very well not have been Flight 175. When I was in Chicago, I asked to take the pictures to United Airlines, and I was rebuffed. United Airlines said it was very offensive to even suggest that that was not their plane, and they were completely unwilling to discuss the anomalies. Now, this gets to the question of, if that plane was in fact a Boeing 767-300 tanker, who would have had such a plane, who would have had the capability to produce such a plane, and who would have had the capability to rig the plane so that it would be remotely guided, for example, and fly into a homing signal coming from some computer inside the building. And lastly, who would have the ability to conceal this evidence afterwards?
And well, also, you know, to choreograph it with other events of that day.
Right, like inserting it into the, we know the military was having this this big exercise involving many planes and NORAD. And to insert aircraft into this game, into this game plan, onto the board, to insert extra players, and then to mask their identity or to make them appear to be something other than what they were. It involves a huge, sophisticated, and very carefully planned state-sponsored agency. And this is the point of my latest discovery. This is the essence of it, is where did those planes come from? Specifically, in this case, we're talking about Flight 175 and Flight 11. Where did they come from and who produced them, if they were, in fact, not Flight 175? And I don't want to give away the whole amount of the story here, because it's a growing thing, and it's very complicated. But you'll remember that both of these planes that came from that hit New York City on that day came from Boston's Logan Airport, and in Boston's Logan Airport, the hijackers who are said to have been on those planes would have gone through passenger screening through a company called Huntley USA. Huntley USA is owned by an Israeli company, which is run by veteran Mossad officers, which is based in Holland. And that company is called ICTS, stands for International Consultants on Targeted Security. Now, what we find is that on the board of directors, for at least 10 years, for 4 or 5 years prior to September 11th, and for 4 or 5 years post 9/11, we have an American named Gerald Gittner. I believe he's American. In any case, he was a very high executive with Pan Am Airlines, with TWA, with Texas International, with Texas Air, People's Express, Kitty Hawk. He was also on the board of directors, not only of ICTS, but of a company called Atasco. Atasco. Now, Atasco is a company that is very seldom described in the American press. It's very hard to find out what Atasco is. On August 15th, 2006, I called Yaron Shalom. Shalom, Yaron. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Yaron." And I asked him about his little company, Atasco, that he was the chairman of. The company that he left Israel at age 50 to be the chairman of. Now, it's interesting that his biographies say he was appointed to be the chairman of this American company, Atasco. Now, how would an Israeli man involved in Israeli military activities be appointed to an American company if that company were not linked to or affiliated with the Israeli military? Well, sure enough, Atasco is affiliated with the Israeli military. In fact, the Israeli military spawned this company. I use the word spawned because the Israeli military and the Mossad spawn companies like a fish lays eggs. They lay their eggs. They come from the ocean and lay their eggs on the East Coast and the West Coast and the South. And these eggs are left, and then they hatch, and some of the companies prosper and do well. But they're all connected to the mothership. They're all connected to the State of Israel and to the Mossad. And Atasco is the same. Atasco was spawned by the Bedek, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Israeli military establishment. and it was created in 1971. And in 1973, it was completely taken over by a man named Shaul Eisenberg. And Shaul Eisenberg is one of these archetypical Israeli billionaires who roam the world running huge corporations with many, many companies, very much like Arnon Milchan. There's a pattern here. And Eisenberg is central to the Israeli presence in China, in Shanghai, in Hong Kong, and in Panama. And in Panama is where Atasco began its business on the North American continent. And then when Mr. Shalom Iran came to the United States in 1979, they opened up their New York office, Atasco, which stands for, it's a air transportation and services company, something like that. In any case, it is a aviation leasing company. Now, at the same time, Bedeck and Israeli aircraft industries spawned aircraft maintenance companies like Commodore in Miami, which has now become Empire Air, I think, in Rome, New York. And there are many others. And these Israeli aviation companies are linked to the largest U.S. airlines through the personnel, people like Gerald Gittner. While Gittner is the chairman of Atasco, he's also working with Pan Am, TWA, Texas Air, People's Express. And what's interesting is that you find that Mr. Gittner is like some of these other people, is that they come into an airlines when it is in its dying days, and they dispose of the assets of the company. So that is where I'm going to, as far as I'm going to go on this subject, because there's a lot of connections and ties that have to be drawn and presented in a subsequent radio program after I finish the article. But if the listeners are interested in the research and in the connections of Pan Am, TWA, the Israeli aircraft industries, and 9/11, they should send a donation to my website.
Or also send us email and tell us about your wishes, whether you'd like Christopher to continue with audio files or you would support his research. Then we know whether our efforts have any...
And what address should they send to?
They can send it to feedback@bolin.com.
Okay. Very good. So now we'll take another break, and we'll come back with the final segment of this program in a minute or two. Thank you very much. Hello again, this is Christopher Bolin with Helya Kaskel, and this is the last segment of this first audio file we're making. This is to complement my research that I'm doing about September 11th. And I want you to know that unlike other researchers who have called themselves researchers in the past who say that they have moved beyond 9/11, discussing 9/11 and have gone on to, you know, making the world a better place or something, I haven't moved on. I'm still working on September 11th because September 11th is an unsolved crime. Just like I told CNN in January of this year, it's an unsolved crime. I don't know who did it, but I can certainly give some pretty good evidence that would indicate who appears to have done it. And, but most importantly, so the cover-up of September 11th, which is happening now, is revealing who is behind the cover-up. And we have Alvin K. Hellerstein in the courtroom in New York City, where all the litigation is being corralled or bottlenecked in his courtroom. And Mr. Hellerstein has not allowed for any trials to determine liability to go forward. The next trial on September 5th, in fact, the five remaining trials that are scheduled are all to determine the amount of damages and the amount of compensation. That's very important because the defendants, like the Israeli company ICTS through its Huntley USA subsidiary, the airlines and the other passenger security companies, what have you, these defendants do not have to produce, do not have to defend their actions, do not have to explain their actions. They don't have to explain what they did or what they didn't do. There are only 21 cases remaining at last report. And that means that it may happen. And the tendency is, or the emphasis is, the pressure of the court is to settle all of the 9/11 litigation lawsuits out of court. Now, how can we as Americans allow this terrible atrocity, this crime of mass murder and terrorism to pass without any discovery as to the accountability? What did the Huntley USA people do? Where are the videotapes of the passengers getting on the plane? Where are the original passenger lists? Who saw the Arabs get on the plane, et cetera, et cetera? Where are we going to get accountability for September 11th if we let all of these cases go to be settled out of court? Now, this is what the court wants. Alvin Hellerstein wants all the cases settled out of court. That's very important. Now, Mr. Chertoff, in his role, has blocked the investigation and is preventing the even Congress from seeing the evidence of September 11th. Now, this is very important because if the planes that struck the World Trade Center, the South Tower, for example, if that really was Flight 175, then that jet engine that landed on the street and the landing gear that landed on the building next door or down the street would have time-track parts on it that would precisely identify when they were put onto the aircraft, where, when, and who did it. Now, the question is, why would the FBI not present the parts from that jet engine or the landing gear from any of the crash sites if those planes were indeed the Boeing aircraft they said they were? Now, that doesn't make any sense. Now, that's why this article, my first article, is about the planes and where the planes came from and who played a role in providing those planes. This is the last segment of this show. We're not gonna go into any more detail. I really want to thank my readers and listeners who have supported me in the past few weeks, and I depend on that support to do programs like this and to continue my research. We as Americans and as citizens of the world, we have an obligation to solve these crimes, not only for ourselves and our posterity, but in order to prevent them from happening again. If we allow things like Flight 800 if we allow things like the Estonia catastrophe and 9/11 to go unsolved, then the criminals who conducted these operations will continue to be in power. And as Werner Etterbach told me, former head of the German Verfassungsschutz, intelligence, he told me in December 2001, he said that 9/11 was clearly done by a state agency, a state-controlled agency that had the assets and the people and the time and the expertise to carry out such a sophisticated operation. Now, if that's the case, which I believe it is, the logical deduction is that these people are still in power and that the people are at the highest levels of power in the United States, which is to say to people like Mr. Chertoff and the other people in the United States administration who are involved in covering up this crime, the Department of Justice, FBI, and in the courts, are complicit in a cover-up of mass murder. Now, why we can't walk away from 9/11, we can't abdicate our responsibilities as citizens to demand that the truth come out, because the administration has used 9/11 as the reason, as the cause, as the foundation of this fraudulent war on terror. And Bush and Cheney and other officials in the Bush administration have promised that this is going to be a long, extensive, drawn-out, global conflict in which the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Lebanon are only the opening salvos. That is to say that these people, these fanatics who are behind September 11th false flag terror, intend to take this war on to other places, to Iran, to other countries in the Middle East, because their game plan is something called Balkanization of the Middle East. Now, you cannot build a house, you can't build history on lies. Unfortunately, many lies do get by, but September 11th is a pack of lies. And if we cherish our freedoms, and if we believe in the truth, and if we want to have a better world, if we want to have a peaceful world, if we want to develop, we have to expose the lies. It's as simple as that. Anybody who says that they've moved beyond September 11th is assisting in the cover-up, because there has been no meaningful discovery in the court. Not a single victim's lawsuit has gone to trial, and the guilty parties have not been found. If, in fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Guantanamo is, in fact, the mastermind of 9/11, as the military and Dick Cheney says he is, why isn't he brought to a court, Mr. Hellerstein's court, for example, in New York City? And why isn't this man put on trial so we can find out exactly who and what was behind September 11th? Well, thank you for your time today, Helya.
Thank you.
I just want to finish by telling our readers that this big discovery, crucial discovery I've made about the September 11th and the criminal network behind it, is part one of a, because I can tell you that from the research I've done, the hardest thing to do is to winnow it down to a readable format of a few thousand words that makes sense, because there is so much here. This involves the Colombian drug trade. It involves major airlines. It involves foreign countries. It involves many individuals. And it is a rather elaborate and tangled web. And so there's definitely going to be a lot more to this series of articles, because I have found so much by finding this one loose end and by pursuing this loose end to where it has led, where it has taken me. I've discovered a whole mother load of criminals and criminal activity. So I want to thank you. If you're interested in this research, or if you'd like to hear another audio file, you'd like to support my research, please send a donation by PayPal to shop@bolinbooks.com. That's shop, S-H-O-P, at Bolin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, B-O-O-K-S.com. Or you can visit www.bolin.com and go to About Bolin, and you can see how to support my research and writing there. Thank you very much, and I look forward to, we'll do this again, maybe in a week or two. We'll see how it goes, and that article will be coming out probably to the people who have subscribed on the Monday, the 15th of October, 2007. Okay, until then, thank you very much, and thank you for listening. Bye-bye.